headlines this hour. Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi says that his government's priorities are to improve the country's COVID situation and to resolve economic problems as lawmakers begin debating his proposed cabinet. The senior Taliban official says the group's co-founder Mullah Abdul Ghani Baradar has arrived in Kabul for talks on forming a new government. And the Russian military says that Syria's air defenses shut down 22 of 24 missiles that Israel fired in its recent airstrikes on the country. Well, welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is Muse. Thanks for joining us. Iranian lawmakers have begun reviewing the qualifications of the ministers proposed by President Ebrahim Raisi, who says that his administration is following a multi-pronged approach to improve the country.
The reform program pursued by the administration is the centerpiece of the proposed minister's agenda. The program is based on five pivotal points. First, a statement on the second step of the Islamic revolution. Second, improving Islamic and Iranian values. Third, pursuing economic resilience. Fourth, improving the livelihoods of the people, especially low-income families. Fifth, promoting international relations based on national interests.
Addressing Parliament's Raisi added that justice and progress are the central plank of all the programs offered by the nominated ministers. The president noted that his administration aims to present solutions and strategies to tackle existing challenges. He added that his top priority is to tackle the coronavirus pandemic and to spur the economy. Raisi also underlined that the executive branch is planning to pursue his programs in cooperation with the legislature and judiciary. He said that his administration plans to give a bigger role to the people. A correspondent, Yusuf Jalali, tells us about the process through which Iranian legislators review the credentials of proposed ministers before a vote of confidence.
Every day until Tuesday, the lawmakers hold the vote of confidence sessions here at the Iranian parliament to talk about the top for or against the proposed ministers by Ebrahim Raisi, the Iranian president. So the process goes like this. The first, at 8 a.m. local time, the Iranian president takes the podium at the Iranian parliament, and he has 2.5 hours to defend and introduce his nominated ministers. So after this, after his time ends, 10 lawmakers, 5 pros and 5 cons, will speak for or against the proposed lineup of the Iranian president. So after this process ends, the Iranian president then has 1 hour, 1.5 hours time to, of course, defend once again his proposed lineup after the pros and cons lay out their, of course, opinions about the proposed lineup. The Iranian parliament is a majority principalist parliament, and the Iranian government is a principalist government. So because of this close ties between the Iranian parliament and the Iranian government, so we're expecting that the process of the vote of confidence process will be swift, will wrap up in a matter of few days until Tuesday, and we're expecting that the majority of the proposed picks for Ebrahim Raisi's cabinet to be approved by the Iranian lawmakers.
A Taliban official says that the group's co-founder Mullah Abdul Ghani Baradar is in the capital, Kabul, for talks on a new governing framework for Afghanistan. The official who spoke with the media on the condition of anonymity says that Mullah Baradar has come to the capital to allocate responsibilities and to meet former government leaders and officials. He added that the Taliban would set up separate teams for dealing with Afghanistan's internal security and financial crises. He noted that the withdrawal of Western forces from the country on amicable terms is also on the agenda. The official said that the Taliban will also investigate potential cases of atrocity and crime by its members against civilians. The U.S. says it has airlifted 13,000 people out of Kabul since the Taliban took over Afghanistan's capital Sunday.
This is one of the largest, most difficult airlifts in history. And the only country in the world capable of projecting this much power on the far side of the world with this degree of precision is the United States of America.
Biden made the remarks during a press conference at the White House. He has said that the U.S. has evacuated more than 18,000 people from the war-weary country since July. Biden said that he cannot guarantee the final outcome of the emergency evacuation from Kabul Airport. Two top human rights organizations have asked Washington to extend a deadline for U.S. troops to help evacuate Afghans fearing Taliban reprisals. We were earlier joined by our correspondent in Kabul, Amin Alami. He gave us the details of the latest political developments in Afghanistan.
According to Taliban sources here in Kabul, after the arrival of Mullah Baradar, the group has decided to directly talk to some political leaders, politicians, well-known figures, and also the leaders of resistance fronts in northern Afghanistan, who are saying that we will resist against the Taliban to remove them from power. However, the Taliban says that we are after establishing an inclusive government that should represent the will of all ethnic groups and religious groups in Afghanistan. However, the Taliban has so far proved to be after gaining legitimacy inside Afghanistan and abroad. They are trying, for instance, to be friendly with the people, despite some reports that they have had some violent actions against the people of Afghanistan, mainly against the residents of capital Kabul and western Herat. But none of Taliban officials here in Kabul have so far confirmed such reports. However, sources close to Ahmad Massoud, the leader of resistance front in northern Panjshir province of Afghanistan, also say that a group of negotiators of the Taliban has arrived in this northern province of Afghanistan to discuss with the leadership of resistance front there. The source also confirms that we will wait and see whether they are after bringing peace here or they are after waging further war in this country.
The Russian President Vladimir Putin has criticized Western governments for trying to impose outside values on war-torn Afghanistan.
The irresponsible policy of imposing someone's alien values from the outside and efforts to build democracy in other countries according to an alien template without taking into account either historic, national or religious peculiarities, completely ignoring the traditions according to which other peoples live, needs to be stopped.
Putin made the remarks at a joint press conference with the German Chancellor Angela Merkel in Moscow. He was referring to the Taliban's takeover of Afghanistan last weekend. The Russian president said that the Taliban controlling Afghanistan is a new reality that the world must accept. He urged the world to help the Afghan people and prevent the collapse of their country. Putin stressed that Russia is interested in a stable Afghanistan, highlighting the significance of forging close ties with the country. The UN World Food Program is warning that over 14 million people in Afghanistan are at risk of severe or acute hunger. 2 million Afghan children are also at risk of malnutrition. We earlier discussed the issue with our guests in our news review program. Let's take a listen.
Now, welcome everyone to the News Review program, where we get in-depth in one of the day's top stories. Now, the UN World Food Program has warned a third of Afghanistan's population is at risk of severe or acute hunger due to war and drought. WFP Country Director for Afghanistan said the dire condition threatens 14 million people in the country, while 2 million children are at risk of malnutrition. Mary Ellen McGorty added that 2021 is an extraordinarily difficult year as a horrendous humanitarian crisis unfolds in the country. Wheat production has plummeted 40% in Afghanistan after one of the driest spells in almost three decades. McGorty said that this has also had a devastating impact on livestock. Moreover, she added that escalating conflict throughout the country has forced farmers from their homes and prevented them from harvesting their land. And now joining us for this program is Allison Weir, founder and executive director of If Americans Knew California, and Mark Weber, director at Institute for Historical Review, joining us from California as well. Hello, and I'd like to welcome you both to the program. Allison, I guess we're going to start with you. Your thoughts on both the man-made catastrophe erupting in Afghanistan, and along with the obvious nature, we have drought,
We have a, even when we don't have drought, it seems like now farmers are being driven away from their land. So your prospects for the future of Afghanistan and its people?
It's a disastrous situation, I think, as everyone watching the news coverage realizes. We had 20 years of a U.S. war in Afghanistan, and no one really knows why we were at war with Afghanistan. What was the purpose? What was the goal? It just dragged on year after year after year. Polls show that two-thirds of Americans oppose that war, don't think we should have been doing it. Two-thirds of Americans also think that the Iraq war was a mistake, and yet somehow our government and our politicians from both parties kept us in these. So now in Afghanistan, there's tragedy, devastation, much of it caused by the war. Although I was in the Peace Corps in Afghanistan many years ago, 69 to 71, and it was all, even at that time, a poverty-stricken country, people sometimes working for 10 cents a day. In about 1971, there was famine then, I recall, a great deal of food insecurity and suffering. So this isn't new, it's just that the U.S. invasion has clearly made things even worse. And many Americans are extremely disturbed at that reality. And yet, despite the fact that here in the San Francisco area where I live and in other parts of the United States, there have been many demonstrations against these wars, but somehow the people who want peace, which are the majority of Americans, seem to have trouble getting it.
Hmm. Thank you. Mr. Mark Weber, I'd like to welcome you to the program. Sir, your initial thoughts on the story.
I'm very concerned that so much of the focus is on the suffering that we see on television right now. Everyone is moved, of course, by these terrible images, and people are very focused on the tragedy and the suffering and the death and so forth of the past 2 weeks. But I'm more concerned about the lack of historical perspective, the larger perspective, because this has been going on for 20 years. The killing, the waste, the squandering has been going on all these years and should have been given greater emphasis many, many years ago, because the mistake and the horrors and the suffering didn't happen just in the last 2 weeks. This has been going on for a great long, long, long time. I'm more concerned that the Biden administration, even though it deserves some credit, I suppose, for finally pulling out after a catastrophic, a terrible fiasco that has cost trillions of dollars and so many American lives, that the Biden administration, like other administrations, is still committed to policies which will create new and terrible tragedies like this one in the future. Remember, this isn't a mistake of just the Biden administration or the Trump administration. This is a bipartisan effort that's been going on by the Bush administration, the Barack Obama administration, the Trump administration, even though Trump promised to leave. I'm more concerned about the hubris and about the inattention, misguided nature of American foreign policy in a larger way, because the ignorance or the willful ignorance or the deceit that's been involved in the Afghan catastrophe characterizes so much of U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East generally. And I could, whether it's with regard to Syria, whether it's with regard to the Palestine issue, whether it's with regard to Iran, and so forth. The Biden administration is only pulling out of Afghanistan now because the cost has gone on now so badly and so long that finally, with numerous strong American will to pull out, but the dangers of a new and equally bad, terrible thing are very likely in the years ahead, because the essential outlook has not changed. It's true that most Americans are against the Afghan war, but they continue to vote for people who carry out these policies. Remember, Joe Biden was vice president for 8 years in an administration that actually increased the number of troops and that carried out this and made these kinds of mistakes. I'm more concerned that there's no accountability for the American leaders and the both political and military who have misguided the American public, either out of gross ignorance or out of deliberate deceit. Whatever, in either case, such people shouldn't be counted on to lead any kind of country, as we've seen now dramatically in the last few weeks in the case of Afghanistan.
Thank you both for joining us. The time has gotten the better of us, but do appreciate both your input here, Allison Weir, founder and executive director at If Americans Knew, and Mr. Mark Weber, director at the Institute for Historical Review, both joining us out of sunny California. And that's a wrap for this segment of your News Review program. Thank you for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
Welcome back. Australia has reported a record high number of daily coronavirus cases, despite nearly 2 months of a lockdown in its epicenter of the disease. Officials reported a total of 886 cases in New South Wales and Victoria states. The bulk of infections were registered in the capital of New South Wales, Sydney. The state also reported 3 deaths in the past 24 hours. Sydney has been under lockdown since late June after a Delta variant-fueled outbreak. On Friday, state authorities extended the stay-at-home order until the end of September. The extension sparked anger among Sydney residents who hit the streets despite a ban. Similar protests were also held in Melbourne. Police clashed with protesters in both cities, making hundreds of arrests. Meanwhile, the number of COVID-19 cases in New Zealand keeps rising, largely due to the spread of the highly transmissible Delta variant in the country. New Zealand officials recorded 21 new cases of the virus on Saturday. That brought the total infections in the previously COVID-free country to 51. The majority of the new cases have been detected in the country's largest city, Auckland. Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern says that the cases could be increasing next week. New Zealand registered its first COVID case in more than 6 months earlier this week. The country immediately went into a nationwide lockdown, which has been extended until at least Tuesday midnight. Since the start of the pandemic, New Zealand has recorded just 26 coronavirus-related deaths. That's all the time we have for this edition of World News. So bye-bye for now.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba vujood qudde saratani Israel mukhalifim.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Majh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
March 18, 2002. The prophets save humans. So in the Quran, one important purpose of prophethood is said to be establishing justice. We sent our messengers with clear evidence to support their truthfulness, and sent with them the book and the balance so that people would maintain justice. Quran, chapter 57, verse 25. In fact, the divine books and the prophets were sent in order for justice to be established in societies, that is, to remove the symbols of oppression, coercion, and corruption. The movement of Imam Hussein was a movement of such nature. He said, "I rose up to reform the Muslim community of my grandfather, Prophet Muhammad." He also said, "Whoever observes a ruler legalizes what God has made unlawful, violating the covenant of God, opposing the sunnah of the messenger of God, and treating the creatures of God sinfully and oppressively, he who does not oppose him with his speech and action, God has a right to bring him to the same fate as that of the tyrant."
Ana mazlum Hussein, ana mazlum namaz.
Ana latshan.
Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, made the army of reason overcome the army of ignorance.
Ana latshan.
Ana latshan.
That is, if a person sees where corruption and oppression emerge from, yet they do not do anything to oppose the source of corruption and oppression for God the Exalted, they have the same fate as the corrupt oppressor. He said that he did not rise up for the cause of wickedness, amusement, corruption, or oppression. The people of Iraq invited Imam Hussein to rule over them, and Imam Hussein answered their request. So it is not that Imam Hussein did not think of creating a government. He was indeed thinking of overturning tyrannical powers, either by taking the government away from them or by martyrdom. Imam Hussein knew what would his silence, his endorsement, and his indifference would do to Islam if he did not take any action. When a power takes all the capacities of a community or some communities under control and acts tyrannically, if the men of truth do not oppose him, refuting his actions, they have actually endorsed his actions. That is, oppression is endorsed by the men of truth, without them really wanting it.
Africa Today.
African countries are deploying troops in Mozambique to combat terrorists in the country's grassroots Cabo Delgado province, which has witnessed deadly attacks by Takfiri terrorists and rebels. Recent attacks forced global energy giants to stop activities in the region, while locals have borne the brunt of the violence. One of those affected gives an eyewitness account on what happened during an attack by terrorists. Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a warm welcome to another edition of Africa Today, a program which gives you an incisive analysis on events taking place across Africa. Now, in the first segment of our program, we are focusing on the decision by several African countries to join in Mozambique's war on Takfiri terrorists. We are asking, what are the chances of success in this mission, and what's the French connection? In the second part of our program, we shall focus on the situation in Nigeria, where children have been forced out of school due to an upsurge in abductions, especially in the northern part of this West African country. A parent of one of the abducted children speaks here during a protest gathering.
We stand in one voice, we condemn what has happened, and we'll protest, we'll continue to protest until our children are brought back.
African forces join Mozambique's war on terror.
Since 2017, armed militants linked to Takfiri terrorist groups including Daesh have been on the offensive in the northern Mozambique energy-rich province of Cabo Delgado. The human toll of this violence is grave, with more than 3,000 killed, nearly a million displaced, and an acute hunger crisis. With several thousand fighters, the Daesh-affiliated Al-Shabaab in Mozambique has conducted increasingly sophisticated military operations, including by reportedly working with intelligence cells within the Mozambican military. Regional bloc, the Southern African Development Community, also known as SADC, and Rwanda are following up on committed troop deployments and training missions. Speaking during a SADC summit in April this year, Botswana's president, Mokgweetsi Masisi, said the region cannot remain indifferent to the insecurity in Mozambique.
We cannot stay indifferent as our fellow compatriots in a SADC member state continue to wallow under the atrocious, brutal, and indiscriminate assaults meted out on them by these faceless terrorists. For these attacks are a clear affront to the SADC vision of a region that is peaceful, stable, secure, and prosperous.
The Southern African Development Community held an extraordinary summit on June the 23rd and approved the deployment of what is known as the SADC Standby Force in support of Mozambique to combat terrorism in Cabo Delgado. Now, the bloc's executive secretary elaborates here at the end of the one-day summit in Mozambique's capital, Maputo.
Seven summit endorsed the recommendations of the report of the chairperson of the Organ on Quality, Defense and Security Cooperation and approved the mandate for the SADC Standby Force mission to the Republic of Mozambique to be deployed in support of Mozambique to combat terrorism and the acts of violent extremism in Cabo Delgado.
Now, for more analysis on the situation in Mozambique and the deployment of regional forces to combat terrorists, we have contacted Dr. Yusuf Adam, a Mozambican historian and academic. Thanks a lot, sir, for your time. Now, first, can you tell us some of the reasons for the current insurgency in Mozambique, which has been going on for several years now?
These areas of Cabo Delgado, etc., are areas which have been have a big problem with youth. They have a youth bulge. The second problem we have to mention is corruption. Corruption is rampant in Mozambique. The problem which we also have to take into consideration is environmental destruction. And the problem is that the companies which are going to exploit petrol inland and onshore and inland, they have limited certain areas. And these areas are off limits for the local fishermen.
Well, clearly from what Dr. Adam has just said, the insurgency in Cabo Delgado is partly due to grievances by local people who are suffering from neglect by the government and exploitation by global energy giants in the region.
In Cabo Delgado, thousands of people are being forced from their land to make way for gas exploration by Western fossil fuel giants Shell, Eni, ExxonMobil, Total, and others. Instead of locals benefiting from their immense natural resources, they are seeing poverty, conflict, debt, and pollution. What prompted regional African countries to make the drastic decision to send troops to Mozambique years after insurgents started their attacks?
At this moment, the war has been increasing, yes. The Mashababus they had attacked Mocimbo, but then they attacked Palma. And at the moment they attacked Palma, mainly means that they have stopped or they have obliged the French company Total to stop its activities and many other companies which worked for Total. And at that time also, there was very big coverage in the press internationally about what was going on in the region.
Rwanda, which is not a member of the Southern African Development Community, was the first African country to deploy troops in Mozambique. Now, sources say SADC was concerned about a non-member country deploying soldiers in the region without its approval and ahead of the bloc's own troops.
Mozambique insists that while it remains committed to working with SADC to restore peace to the northern region, it can partner with other African states to address its security challenges. There have been reports that Rwanda is sending troops to Mozambique to protect massive economic interests of France. However, Rwanda's military spokesman says the deployment follows a request by Maputo.
The purpose of this mission, first of all, is based on a request by the government of Mozambique to the government of Rwanda to help support in conducting military operations, including the security operations and stabilization, as well as security sector reform. So this was a request by the government of Mozambique to the government of Rwanda, and this is part of a bilateral agreement that we had since 2018.
Rwanda is the only African country outside the SADC bloc to deploy troops in Mozambique. Rwanda's decision came after Emmanuel Macron's visit to Kigali. Now, is Rwanda probably acting on behalf of France to protect French energy giants engaged in Mozambique LPG projects?
I think that the Rwandese at this moment are some kind of private army. They are all Tutsis. It's a private army. It's a private army which belongs to a state, which is Rwanda, and they are attacking. They are in Mozambique. They came first. Until now, there are the information which we have about their activities are more or less part of the propaganda that they have. I think that basically the Rwandese are going to stay around the Afungi and create an area of 25 miles of radius, more or less, around the Afungi, which was the area and the conditions that Total had asked the Mozambican government.
SADC deployment of troops and equipment to Mozambique has been welcomed by many local and international observers. Southern African states had been under pressure to mobilize and help the Mozambican forces to restore security and ensure civilian protection against attacks in Cabo Delgado.
Now, the main argument in favor of a regional intervention is the risk of a violent spillover into Mozambique's neighboring states. However, regional troops face many challenges, chief among them financial resources to fund the troops and experience in battling insurgents. Now, do you think regional forces will eventually restore stability in the restive Cabo Delgado province?
Yes, inshallah. I hope we will manage. And what we have to do at this moment is to combat the root causes of this war, which is having more girls in schools, so we don't have this youth bulge. We have to have the proper participatory development where the population feels that what they need is given back to them, water, sanitation, health, roads, infrastructure, etc. Job creation at a massive scale, so the young people can really feel the benefits of the development.
Well, there you have it. Our guest says the solution to the insurgency in Mozambique is to ensure that the people benefit from the country's resources. But will the insatiable greed by the mainly French energy giants allow the people of Cabo Delgado to benefit from their wealth of this region? Now let's take a short break, and when we come back, we shall focus on school children in Nigeria and how they have been affected by insecurity.
children affected by Nigeria's insecurity.
Since December last year, more than 1,000 Nigerian students and staff have been abducted and held for ransom by criminal gangs and terrorists in the dense forests of the northern part of this West African country. Now, humanitarian agencies warn that an alarming rise in abductions is disrupting education of hundreds of thousands of Nigerian children.
Since the infamous kidnapping of 276 girls from a school in Chibok, Borno State in 2014 by the Takfiri terrorist group Boko Haram, school attacks and kidnappings have steadily increased. And in the last 6 months, incidences have risen sharply. The United Nations Children's Agency, UNICEF, estimates that around 1,125 schools are closed across northwest Nigeria. Peter Hawkins, the UNICEF representative in Nigeria, elaborates on the situation of education in Nigeria.
The situation of education in Nigeria is probably at its biggest crisis point at the moment. There are in the region of 13.2 million children out of school in total, which is the highest number globally.
Some northern states of Nigeria like Zamfara, Katsina, Borno, Kaduna, and Niger have been especially vulnerable to these school kidnappings due to a proliferation of these armed criminal gangs and terrorists. A student who was kidnapped and later released speaks here on what the kidnappers say is their motive.
They say, we are not after you, we are after the government. You now ask them, what did the government do to you? They said, government promised them and they failed it. What did the government promise? They now tell us that the government promised during the election, as in the election, this political rally, they promised them to give them good hospital, good shelter, good school, and those that are not working, they promised them to be giving them monthly allowance.
Now, for more on the state of the kidnappings of students in Nigeria and how this has affected education in the country, we have contacted Edward Corrigan, an international human rights lawyer. Thanks a lot for your time, sir. Now, our first question, how serious is the problem of children failing to go to school in parts of Nigeria due to insecurity?
The problem is very serious. There's over 1,000 children have been kidnapped. There was an incident in 2014, I believe, where over nearly 300 female students were kidnapped. And just recently, 140 boys were kidnapped from the Bethel Baptist High School. So it's very serious. In fact, a number of the five or six states in northeastern Nigeria have actually shut down all the schools to try to prevent these students from being kidnapped and held for ransom. And of course, the government is refusing to pay ransom, even though in the end, I think it has happened.
Thanks for that insight, Mr. Corrigan.
Organized crime syndicates have adopted a kidnap and ransom tactic, and this has forced state officials to negotiate with criminals and pay them millions of dollars in ransom to secure freedom for many school children. The government has rejected claims of paying ransom. After years of terrorist attacks, kidnapping of school children is a recent phenomenon in Nigeria. Why have the kidnappings escalated?
Part of the problem is that there are criminal groups and bandits that are kidnapping children and holding them for ransom, for money. So you have this additional factor plus the Boko Haram and also another group called the Islamic State for West Africa Province. It's ISWAP. But they have split off from Boko Haram and they're actually now sort of the dominant group because they just actually killed the leader of Boko Haram, who was a little bit of a crazy man, Abu Bakr Sadaku, who supposedly was killed at the orders of the Islamic State in the Middle East. But you have criminal groups that are trying to make money, taking advantage of the chaos and instability that exists in the area. And there are grievances within the tribal groups and also the Islamic community against the central government.
Criminal gangs, locally called bandits, have been operating in northwestern Nigeria for more than a decade. But when they were reportedly infiltrated by members of the Takfiri terrorist group Boko Haram in December, the abductions and violence escalated. A parent whose child was killed by kidnappers is urging the government to take action.
Government should be proactive. They should not just keep quiet. They should be proactive to help the situation because it's getting out of hand.
Now, Mr. Corrigan, do you think the criminals engaged in kidnapping of school children in Nigeria are collaborating with Boko Haram and other Takfiri terrorist groups?
Some definitely are. Some are independent operators. And, of course, there are factions within Boko Haram itself, which some of which are out of control. But they, Boko Haram started when the government killed a leader of the Islamic community back in 2009, and that sort of sparked the insurgency in northeast Niger and Nigeria, and also the border area of Niger. So you have, 40,000 killed, 2 million people are displaced, and you have a very serious problem. So Boko Haram is doing this to generate money and also to gather followers. They're trying to probably recruit child soldiers, but the main purpose seems to be to get ransom and money, which both would fund terrorism but also criminal activities.
This mass kidnapping of Nigerian school children points to major security challenges in Africa's most populous nation amid concerns that the increasing number of students not reporting to school due to insecurity will result in a lost generation of youth. Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari has on several occasions said his government is working hard to restore security.
The law enforcement agencies are working hard to regain confidence against the bandits so that people can go back to the land. This is very important. This is what the law enforcement agents are very busy about now. The rainy season is coming, so we want people to go back to the land.
How is the Nigerian government responding to the current crisis? Is the situation spiraling out of control?
Questions as to where they're getting their funding, where they're getting their arms. Are there external groups, supporting them? Because, of course, Nigeria is a oil-rich country, and it's peculiar that Islamic State has been used by various outside parties to undermine central government authority, and that raises questions of, are there external actors using Boko Haram and other Islamic militant groups to accomplish other objectives and to create chaos and, of course, to extort concessions from the central government.
Nigeria is an oil and gas-rich nation. It is also the largest economy in Africa in terms of nominal GDP and the 26th in the world, according to the IMF World Economic Outlook. So in whose interest is the instability in Nigeria? Now, Mr. Corrigan, our last question to you. Do you think foreign powers or entities are involved in the protracted violence and insecurity in Nigeria by backing Takfiri terrorist groups and other criminal gangs?
Questions as to where they're getting their funding, where they're getting their arms. Are there external groups, supporting them? Because, of course, Nigeria is a oil-rich country, and it's peculiar that Islamic State has been used by various outside parties to undermine central government authority, and that raises questions of, are there external actors using Boko Haram and other Islamic militant groups to accomplish other objectives and to create chaos and, of course, to extort concessions from the central government.
Well, thanks for your time and insight, Mr. Corrigan. Now, we all look forward to a peaceful Nigeria where children feel safe at school and hopeful about their future. That wraps it up for this week's edition of Africa Today. Drop us a line through our social media handle and let us know what you think about today's show. Goodbye for now.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Stories from the past. Stories from the lives of the infallibles. Stories from different parts of the world. On the lantern.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Dear listeners, thank you so very much for joining us on today's episode of The Lantern. As The Lantern tradition, we have a short little story, very interesting, about elephants. About an elephant. I love elephants, by the way. They're so big and beautiful and majestic, and yet so harmless. I know a lot of people get killed by elephants, but then again, it's sort of not the elephant's fault. It's usually our fault for, you know, expanding our infrastructures and trespassing into elephant territory. That's not the point. The point is, please listen to this short anecdote, and we're going to be right back on The Lantern.
In the name of Allah, Salamun Alaikum, dear friend. Welcome to this episode of Lantern. As you know, we have an interesting story at the beginning of each episode. The Blind Man and the Elephant is the title of today's story. Let's listen. A long time ago in India, there lived six men who were all blind since birth. One day, they fell to arguing. The object of their dispute was the elephant. Now, since each was blind, none had ever seen that mighty beast. So to satisfy their minds and settle the dispute, they decided to go and seek out an elephant. Having hired a young guide, they set out early one morning in single file along the forest track, each placing his hands on the back of the man in the front. It was not long before they came to a forest clearing where a huge bull elephant was standing contemplating his menu for the day. The six blind men became quite excited. Thus it was that the men took turns to investigate the elephant's shape and form. "Oh, my brother," the first man at once cried out, "this elephant is like a great mud wall baked hard in the sun." "Now, my brothers," the second man exclaimed, "I can tell you what shape this elephant is. He's exactly like a spear." The others smiled in disbelief.
Why, dear brothers, do you not see, said the third man, this elephant is very much like a rope. Ha, I thought as much, the fourth man declared excitedly. This elephant much resembles a serpent. Good gracious, brothers, the fifth man called out, even a blind man can see what shape the elephant resembles most. Why, he is mightily like a fan. At last it was the turn of the sixth old fellow, and he proclaimed, this sturdy pillar, brothers, mine, feels exactly like the trunk of a great Arica palm tree. This curiosity satisfied, they all linked hands and followed the guide back to the village. Once there, seated beneath a waving palm, the six blind men began disputing loud and long. Each now had his own opinion, firmly based on his own experience. For after all, each had felt the elephant for himself and knew that he was right. And so indeed he was. For depending on how the elephant is seen, each blind man was partly right, though all were in the wrong.
The lantern.
Under the light of lantern, we'll look at the story, which indicates a moral aspects of our life.
All right, so maybe the story was more about six blind men than an elephant, but that elephant was involved. And we have to point out the elephant in the room, pun intended. And because I love elephants so much, I think I already said that. The point is, so six blind men go around and wondering about how an elephant looks like. They've never seen what an elephant looks like. They decide to go check out an elephant, and they check it out the way blind people do, which is a very extraordinary process. It's like their eyes are on the tip of their fingers. And they touched, even because an elephant is huge, obviously, each of them is touching one part of the elephant. One could be touching the trunk, one could be touching the tail, the leg, the skin, the back, the front, the bottom. And they obtain an assessment, each of them, based on the part of the elephant they came in contact with. And they thought to themselves, well, that's how an elephant looks like. Right? They applied it to their previous personal experiences, and they connected the dots together, and 2 + 2 = an elephant looks like a fan. Because probably that blind person had only touched a fan before this. You know, the hugest thing he's ever touched was a fan. And he made the comparison in his head, and he came to that conclusion. Can we say that that experience, that respected, visually impaired individual went through was wrong? No. It was a personal experience that he went through with all his capacities, with all his facilities that he had been equipped with, and he deduced a conclusion from those prefaces. And we've all done that in our lives. Was the conclusion he reached wrong? Yes and no. No, in the sense of, well, an elephant does not look like a fan. I can't imagine any part of an elephant that resembles a fan. Well, maybe the ears. Oh yeah, the big flappy ears, right? They resemble the thingies of the fan, the plates of the fan. But that's the last thing people who can see fans and who can see elephants would think of, you know, to compare elephants with anything. And also, no, he wasn't wrong, because that was his thought process. That was really the experience he went through that led him to this conclusion. Can anyone tell him that no, a fan doesn't? The fan that you felt is not like that? That's how he felt it. Can anyone tell him that no, the elephant you touch is not like that? That's how he touched it. So on one hand, he was right. The part of the elephant he touched really resembles the part of the fan he touched. And on the other hand, he was wrong. Sweetheart, elephants and fans have nothing in common. What's the point here, you might be wondering? Well, the point is, we do that so often in our lives, and we need to be aware that as much certainty I can have regarding my conception, my perception of a certain matter, because my own experiences, knowledge, and logic and mindset has led me to that conclusion, and to me, it's totally correct beyond a shadow of a doubt. Other people might feel like that toward their opinions as well. That doesn't necessarily mean all my opinions are entirely wrong or all other people's opinions are entirely wrong, but that definitely means we should keep an open mind regarding other people's opinions and our opinions and the possibility that maybe it's not as foolproof as I thought it was. Maybe I don't have all the facts right. Maybe the data I've received through my perception and my experiences are, in fact, flawed. That might come as a revelation to a lot of us, but it's the true fact of life. Sometimes I talk to my niece about things, and I tell her a rule, and her current catchphrase is, "But that don't make no sense." Right? If I were a few generations older, I would probably throw a sandal at her and tell her, "How dare you talk back at me and say what I said does not make sense." But because I listen to TED Talk, I think to myself, she's right. It doesn't make any sense to her. Through her faculties, through her perception, through her limited understanding and experience of life, that does not make any sense. And as an adult, as a caretaker, as a guardian, it's my fault, it's my job to sit on the floor, eye level with her, and explain to her different possibilities that she never thought of. Introduce her to other matters, other factors, other information, and help her make sense of that. Thank you so very much for being with us on this episode of The Lantern. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
That was all for today. Thank you very much for joining us. Inshallah, we continue this topic on the next episode. Till then, may Allah bless all of you. Fi amanillah.